You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
They had one where there was a guy who was still carrying the fish that he'd bought for his wife's dinner on the way home, then assaulted a woman, and then they nicked him, and he was just carrying this fish, and he had to phone the wife, and then she was like, just give me the fish.
The fish is the least of your problems at this point, right?
Exactly. It was like, your husband's just been nicked for doing this.
Kat is Cosmopolitan UK's multiple award-winning commissioning editor, who has won BSME awards for both her long-form investigative journalist pieces, as well as for leading the Cosmopolitan Features Department. Alongside commissioning and editing the feature section, both online and in print, Kat also regularly writes her own hard-hitting investigations, spending months researching some of the most pressing issues affecting young women today. She has spent time with undercover specialist police forces, domestic abuse social workers, and even Playboy bunnies to create articles that take readers to the heart of the story. Kat is also a published writer, poet, and volunteers with a number of organizations that directly help the homeless in London. When she's not in the Cosmopolitan office, you can find her challenging her weak ankles in towering heels through the streets of Soho. So welcome to the studio, Kat. If you'd asked 14-year-old me what I wanted to do, it would basically be your job now. Like, so I want to know how you got into it, because I didn't know anyone that did it. So like, I'd never had anyone to ask how they did it.
Well, that was the same. Like, I grew up in kind of late 90s, early noughties, and magazines were just my world. They were like my dream. I was obsessed with them. And then my mum was a feminist writer. She was kind of, she worked in newspapers and was kind of a little bit like down on magazines, whereas I was very much like, no, women's magazines, it's working in the media produced by women. And I just set my sights on it. I was like, and it was really hard because I'm from Edinburgh. Obviously everything is down in London. I studied journalism at Sheffield. I used to even make like wee magazines for my friends, like cut things out and gift them. And like, I was really focused. I'd even go and like, this is so sad, I'd go and stand outside the Cosmopolitan offices and cry because I wanted to work there. Like,
does that
so
work
badly? No, it does not.
Because I might try it after we leave.
It's not how I got my job today. But breaking into it was really, really difficult. It was really hard. I worked for a Here magazine. It was kind of the first job I could get. Most magazines, it's not like this anymore, but most magazines like Cosmo and Glamour, I would expect you to have done a year's work of unpaid work experience.
Oh, wow.
To even get in the door. That was completely unavailable to me. So I eventually got this job in like a really outskirts of London, Hair magazine, and just tried to talk to everyone I could. It took about 5 years of working there and Weight Watchers magazine. So kind of quite unglamorous titles to make it into magazines.
I forgot Weight Watchers even had a magazine until just then. But like, what was the biggest challenge of trying to get into working with like Cosmo?
It was just probably the fact that they saw brands like Weight Watchers and Sound Business is not kind of, and also the sheer number of people applying. It's not necessarily that like that's a bad thing. They saw my experience is not related to them. So it would, you'd have 100 to 150 people applying for a job each time. So essentially, yeah, that was the biggest thing to break into and break through. And eventually I got, after just talking to as many people as possible, I got given 1 week's worth of holiday cover at Look magazine, which was a fashion weekly. Yeah. And I quit my job for 1 week's cover. Once I was in the door, I just was like, I'm really good at this. Like, and tried to show.
That's a really myself. Big risk to like yeah. quit your job.
Oh my God, I was terrified.
Yeah, I would. I'm like terrified yeah. thinking about it. Like I'd be sweating.
Yeah,
you would have to like you would have to put your all into it though. Wouldn't you, if yeah. you knew you put so much on the line,
and I just knew I wanted it so badly, so I was willing to do anything for it.
Glue yourself to the, yeah, to exactly. the desk, like a mini protest.
Yeah,
but like, is it as competitive now? Like, do you still get 100, 150 people apply for a job?
It's not, I wouldn't say it's as competitive now. I think the industry has become a lot more accessible in terms, particularly at Hearst and Cosmo, in terms of trying to make it more fair so we don't do the kind of year worth internships and things. And there's also so many other things you can do. There's so much freelancing you can do. So it's not as competitive, but probably still is as, yeah.
It's kind of like one of those things that it's, you always have, if you know somebody, they like can guide you and make it slightly easier.
Make it easier because it's seen as intimidating as well. Magazines, like I remember I was so scared. I thought everyone was going to be like just full of bitches and horrible people. And I just couldn't even imagine being in the corridors. And then slowly you get to know people, and particularly in features journalism, everyone's just lovely and they're just interested in women's issues. And
I think, well, features journalism is probably different to what you used to do with investigative journalism,
so
right?
Like, well, like feature journalism, it kind of encompasses so much, which is like, obviously it's so different. So Weight Watchers was really different because that was just interviewing. It taught me so much skills though. Like I didn't realize at the time, but talking to women who have gained weight for whatever reason, they've gained weight and they're wanting to lose it, and they've always got a really interesting backstory, and those are really sensitive topics that you have to kind of speak to them about. So I learned quite a lot of really good kind of, yeah, interview skills from that I could then transfer into my current job, which is looking after all the long reads and things at Cosmo. So
when you were like, when you were doing more investigative journalism stuff, like I've seen that you've did so many really interesting pieces. And I was talking to you about how you did a piece with Playboy.
Yep.
And I was like, I want to know everything about it. Like, cause that must've been such a wild experience yeah. to just be like let loose in the bunny house.
So it was around the time that, I mean, obviously there's so much more body positivity now, but it was kind of when it was really breaking onto the scene, and it was like, let's try and test this in kind of the place that's had the most high beauty standards as historic high beauty standards. And I'm a size 16 to 18. So we thought, let's get me out on the floor and working in the casino. So I was trained in how to do the cards. I was trained in how to make the cocktails. I was given a costume specifically made for me. I worked out there. I worked in the club for like 2 days with all the bunnies who were just the nicest girls ever.
Some of the things you were telling me about that you had to learn to be able to like wear the costume yeah. and stuff, like actually blew my mind. It sounds really painful as
so,
well.
You have to learn how to breathe from your chest only, basically, because you're so constricted. Because I was worried about what my body would look like.
Yeah.
But this seamstress just creates the body for you with this corset. It's so tight that, yeah, like everything kind of spills out the back. So you have to wear your hair long. You have to breathe from your chest because you cannot really breathe from your stomach. When I took the corset off, I had welts all up and down me.
Oh my God.
I've got all these photos of just me just like all hanging out with all these welts in. And you have to walk so straight. You cannot. I mean, they have this thing where they say bunnies don't sit. And that's because bunnies can't sit. So even to serve a drink, you have to learn it's this thing called the bunny dip, which is kind of like a squat. You kind of squat and then you serve like that. And then you slowly move your hand back.
What I thought was going to be the bunny house is so different to reality, because in the films it looks so glamorous.
Because this is the London casino, so it's and it's so funny because you think you go in, you kind of feel like you've stepped back in time because you've seen this beautiful woman in the bunny costumes and everything, and it's just all these gamblers not even looking up from their game, just like completely, they do not care.
I'm like, look at me, this hurts. Yeah,
exactly, that was it. Because I thought, oh, it's going to be, someone's going to comment, or maybe someone might say, like, you're not as slim as the other bunnies. Like, no, there was loads of diversity on the bunny floor, and the people just didn't care.
Well, that's really interesting, because I thought it'd be the complete opposite.
Yeah, I thought there'd be a lot of, like, they're very well looked after. There'd be a lot of sexual harassment, etc. But it was just quite a nice atmosphere with lots of lovely women, so I didn't really manage to uncover much, but
Well, I mean, we were briefly talking as well when you were saying that when they were off like shift or walked away, mm-hmm. they would just sit, they'd undo their courses and sit. And I was likening it to how it is when you do a beauty pageant. And now I'd unclip my bikini top and eat Pringles.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone's just like in, like quickly getting the snacks in.
Yeah, like it always looks really glamorous on the front, but if you go to the backstage bit, it's just not.
Yeah.
But you've done some really like, I would call them quite scary mm-hmm. investigative journalism pieces. And I wanted to know, like, what was like the biggest challenge of even going into some of these places?
So, I mean, because I'd say the biggest challenge, so the two biggest challenges I've done is one, this one I was kind of more protected. I mean, you're protected entirely anyway. You rarely go into kind of like an undercover assignment without some sort of care beforehand, without someone there kind of looking after you behind the scenes. I've done that for other journalists. I've got other journalists who do it for me, or you're working with a charity who are kind of aware of you and really looking out for you. But I did one where I was with the police who are called the Grope Police, but they're the TfL Transport Police, whose job it is to catch gropers in the London Underground. And essentially they have to catch them in the act. So I spent a shift with them, and that is, it has to be during rush hour, because that is when unfortunately the gropers really, really take advantage, because they're trying to, it's kind of like a specific breed of sexual predator where they're really trying to zone in on the fact that they're going to be really packed in on women. Okay. And the women aren't going to want to speak out, or might be embarrassed, or might not even think that what they're feeling.
People being bumped into you.
Yeah, they might just think, I mean, I've lived in capital cities all my life, it's happened to me, and you're kind of like, is that, or is it an umbrella? Is it, and they capitalize on that. So the police force that I did that with, that was during the Underground, they're amazing. They're like, they've got incredible eyes for photographic memory. So they're looking out for people, but they're also looking out for people behaving in a way that's different from a normal commuter. So like okay. a normal commuter is looking at the board. They're looking for the quieter areas. One of these men, they're looking for the busy areas.
Right, okay.
And you're having to actually run on and off. As soon as they had a target, you had to run on and off and chase them. So you're running on and off in London rush hour, having to push in. You can't say you're undercover, of course, because you're meant to be a normal commuter.
Yeah.
So that was quite scary, and it was quite, because you're just in that very tense environment. And I was also really conscious of not wanting to mess up their investigation. It's kind of the main thing that scared me in that scenario, which I did almost by making small talk with one of their marks.
So he probably wanted you to assault you, right?
Well, apparently not. So because they were like, you might have to come off because he'll have spotted you following him.
Okay.
But then they were like, he's only got his mark in mind. So
they don't just go around doing it to random people. They're
watching out, and then they'll follow people, and then they see if a guy is going from, say, Oxford Circus back to less, like doing a weird journey, okay. looking out for women. They had like all sorts of stories about like men. They had one where it was a guy who was still carrying the fish that he'd bought for his wife's dinner on the way home, then assaulted a woman, and then they nicked him, and he was just carrying this fish, and they had to phone the wife, and then she was like, just give me the fish.
The fish is the least of your problems at this point, right?
Exactly. It was like, your husband's just been nicked for doing this. So that one was quite like intimidating in terms of that. And then the other one that was probably more intimidating was I spent time with perpetrators of domestic abuse. So I was just sitting in the back of it was a workshop for perpetrators of domestic abuse to kind of show them what they'd done wrong. But that is in a room full of quite intimidating. Like there was this one man who was just sitting in front of me, just farting and staring and leering at me, and then farting and then staring and leering at me again. So it's kind of
such bizarre behavior.
It's just it was very kind of obviously trying to intimidate, trying to scare me, and it's just trying to kind of sit your cool. And I am quite a nervous person. I'm not someone who is naturally very confident, not someone who's not, like, even doing this, I find quite nerve-wracking. So it's just trying to harness that adrenaline in a way. And I also just love throwing myself into things and seeing things. I think it enhances a story, so I always keep that in mind. I mean, another fun one I did, which was scary for completely different reasons, was I did a stand-up comedy set to get over my fear of my nerves. and no one in the audience knew that I was a brand new comic. So I just had to go and do 5-minute comics.
Oh my God. I actually think that would terrify like even the bravest people.
Oh God, there was that. So that was scary, but not in terms of this kind of serious journalism side of it, yeah, or what could happen to me, just more I could make a complete fool of myself.
So how do you manage your nerves and then trying not to give away what you're doing?
So, I mean, mostly I think because, I mean, that's the tough thing, is because I think sometimes I just am such a chatty person. Like I say, I spoke to that guy that I wasn't meant to speak to. So, or as I was saying, I was doing this one where I was helping the police with trying to get those undercover, trying to get the illegal vapes. So I was going into shops for them and trying to propose as a customer. And then they gave me some money to buy something from the shops. And then I'd be going in chatting about the milkshakes and stuff. And then I'd come back out and be like, oh, maybe I was too chatty. There's no real, I just figure that I just have to be as much myself as possible, yeah, and as close to myself as possible within the identity that I'm being or the person that I'm being. Because if you try and pretend to be someone you're not, that's when you're more likely to trip up.
Yeah. Well, when talking about, well, not necessarily tripping up, but in terms of investigative journalism, when you're doing a piece, how do you know when it's time to like pull out of it?
So there's so much kind of safeguarding beforehand, and we've always got like a, as I say, there's always someone on side, or, and we've also always got a, once you've got the story or once you feel comfortable enough, or even if at any point you feel uncomfortable, you pull yourself out. I'd say we once did a piece, which was an undercover piece with one of my colleagues, brilliant Danielle Scott. And that was looking into, there was a game called the Blue Whale Game, which was a suicide game that was online. And these men would target vulnerable young girls in Facebook groups and lure them into this game where they'd have different challenges. I think there was 12 different challenges. And the final thing to win the game, yeah, was suicide. So it was really preying on incredibly, wow, vulnerable young girls. And they'd prey on self-harm forums. They were so, she created a fake profile and we had it, but I was supervising her the whole time, and we had a phone that we kept that she'd do it on. I would take the phone off her. I'd always sit with her on the phone. We'd lock the phone in the drawer. And we always said that once she reached level 3, which we used via makeup, which was kind of, she had to do something. I don't know if I can even say what she did because it wouldn't be, we used makeup for it, and then we pulled her out. We're like, okay, we've said this is where we're going to go with this story. And that's more important than anything else, is making sure that the journalist at the heart of the story feels safe, feels comfortable, than the story itself. If we have to scrap a story, if we don't get a story, we end it. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, because I feel like sometimes if you're living a life or living a role for so long, you become fully invested, or you fully believe what you're doing?
I guess, I mean, because I've never gone that fully immersive, okay, but you do get obsessed with kind of wanting, particularly with this story, it was kind of like, you wanted to keep going to see how far this would take. We were also reporting what was happening to the police. So we were working closely with the police on that story. So it was like how you get involved and you want to protect, and you want to tell the right story, but you also have to really be careful of the journalist at the heart of it.
Yeah, because I think the last investigative journalist piece I saw was on Netflix, and it was when a journalist was posting to be a newly converted Muslim trying to figure out how they recruit ISIS brides. And like, she kind of went away from the people that were supposed to be safeguarding, mm-hmm, her, because she was so invested in,
because you get, yeah, trying to, yeah, get, exactly, the piece, yeah.
And it ended up ruining her whole life.
Oh, so, my goodness, I'll have to watch that.
Yeah, like I was like so into it, and I thought it was a lie because, yeah, you couldn't write what was happening, but she had to like, she ended up having to change her name, mm-hmm, and stuff. So at what point do you know it's time to like end that side of your career?
So, I mean, for me, it'll be the moment that I find myself getting a bit numb to it all, or getting a bit like forgetting that there's real people at the heart of all of these stories. It's always, yeah, been really important to me to make sure that I am not forgetting that these are real issues affecting real people. And that's the reason why I'm in the business. It's not for ego. It's not for anything but telling those stories. So the moment I think if I forgot, or suddenly found I was being insensitive, or just putting the story above anything else, would be the moment I'd want to step away and think, actually, I need to take care of myself, and I need to take care of why I got into this business in the first place.
So is that kind of why you stopped doing the investigative pieces?
I mean, it's essentially just because I'm 38 now. So I edit them all and I commission and I edit all of these pieces for Cosmo still. So we're always sending writers to do various things. It's just I'm not the target Cosmo audience anymore. So I think it's harder for me to go in and like we sent, it was a while back, but there was a thing. Do you remember, obviously, with sugar daddies, but there's all these guys posing as salt daddies.
Oh my God, yeah, yeah, I remember this.
So it's so interesting. They're like pretending they've got money to seduce the woman wanting a salt, wanting a sugar daddy.
Yeah.
So Josie, who's another brilliant journalist, she went on a date with one of them. That's the sort of story that I couldn't do now because I just don't think a salt dad, as sugar daddy or a salt daddy is after a 38-year-old woman anymore, sadly.
I'd really want to, I need to read that piece because I'd actually want to know how you spot the difference between the two.
So this was it. She was like looking at his watch and she was kind of quizzing. She's got funny stories though. She had a pseudonym and then she realized she still had the J around her neck from her necklace. It's just like,
oh God, like that's, yeah. To be fair, did they even pick up on those?
So he
things?
Did actually, and that was my sister's name, quick, like.
Oh, okay. Thank God for that. Yeah. I was thinking, I was like, do men even notice these things?
So yeah, the salt daddies do.
Well, I guess if they're trying to like lure you in for something, right? Did you ever, well, you talked a bit about feeling scared for like wanting to mess things up, but were you ever scared for your own like personal safety?
Not really, because I say in terms of what we do, particularly at Cosmo, I mean, I could imagine if you're going deep in like a big, you're so protected. There's always someone there to kind of keep an eye on you. There's always like a colleague or someone from a charity or, yeah, you kind of, I'm completely protected.
So like if you were commissioning a piece now, what would be like the step before you even get to writing the piece or before the journalist writes the piece?
It would be, well, first of all, just having lots of talks with them about what it involves, setting out what we're going to do. We'd then speak to our legal team. We'd speak to our HR team. I even speak to different kind of mental health charities just to, or professionals to see if any risks that I personally can't foresee. You're putting out a whole plan. You're working together in a whole plan. And then you're doing things where you're setting up. So like I've gone on stories where Jennifer Savin is another amazing journalist that works for Cosmo. She did a big investigation into sex for rent, which was when these men were advertising for, they were advertising for free rooms in exchange for sex. So she went along to meet one of these landlords in a pub. And then I sat back with kind of like my book, like, keeping an eye on her, and we'd spoken to her beforehand about what she felt comfortable with at multiple meetings. So it's kind of just constantly, I think it's important, particularly when working with a younger journalist, to make sure that they know what they're getting themselves in for, discussing it and then seeing if they still want to do the story.
Yeah, because I think like if you were a new journalist and you really wanted to impress your boss, you would probably push your own personal boundaries in order to get a story.
Exactly. And at Cosmo in particular, we don't want that at all. So often we'll choose someone more experienced to do a story, or have someone more experienced to do it, or send someone. Because the thing is, there's ways that you can, all this undercover work, it's really, I say undercover, but we also do so much work shadowing, where that's a way to really tell the story and see something for yourself without actually having to pretend to be someone else, do anything like that. You can just go and work with a charity. So I worked with a charity doing shadowing on suicide hotlines for a couple of months. There's lots of different ways that you can do it, particularly for young journalists, where you're not having to put yourself into any real danger. You're working with someone and you're still getting to live the life of, yeah, like, and these amazing organizations and showcase the story.
I think, because I was going to say, like, if I could never go undercover because I think it would just be too obvious. So I did one night shift with the police and someone took a photo thinking I was getting arrested because I was getting in the back of the car, but I was wearing like a big yellow high-vis, so yeah. It kind of gave it away. But like, I think, and also I'm like you, I'm like a nervous person and I'd forget what I'm doing and just get carried away with something else and then be like,
oh wait, yeah,
what was I supposed to be doing? Have I accidentally just told you my name and where I live? Like, but like, what would you say your biggest success is as in your career so far?
So, I mean, we've done, like, I've won 3 awards, and it's really been about putting those, like, long reads for, because you don't necessarily think of Cosmopolitan as the kind of place for this sort of journalism. So getting those awards and being able to show to the wider world that this is the sort of work that we do is really important. But ultimately, I think it's just being able to take stories that I think are less spoken about. So one of the things I was most proud of, we chatted about at lunch, was when I looked into a couple of years after the Me Too, there was a story about James Dean, who is an adult film star who'd been accused of sexually assaulting his co-stars on set. And we looked into that to see what implications it had for his career. And actually, it turned out it kind of boosted his career. And there was a lot of stories. I mean, he's actually, I should probably say, he flat out denied all the claims, which is in the piece, but just for legal reasons, should put in here too. But lots of these women, so they interviewed these adult film stars for months about not their experiences with him, but their experiences with other stars, and essentially how they just aren't believed at all when they speak out about this stuff because of the nature of their work, which most of the time they absolutely love. But even I spoke to a woman who said that when she called the police for a burglary, someone brought into the fact that what her career was, the police brought into this, and it was like, so it's kind of highlighting those stories. That means a lot to me. And then also, my dad's transgender, so I wrote a piece about my experiences, and I still get messages today from other women with trans parents asking for advice and saying that it meant a lot to them. So just bringing those issues to the forefront is always the thing that, like, I feel most proud of.
I guess it kind of, like, was the reason you got into your job in the first place, yeah. Right? What would you say, like, what to any aspiring journalist? I get a lot of DMs from aspiring journalists, mm-hmm. that want help with, like, certain pieces, or they have to interview somebody, but I actually can't give them advice because it's not my place. But what advice would you give to an aspiring journalist?
I mean, I always think, particularly if you're going to be want to work in features or investigations, it's kind of staying as curious as possible. So many of the biggest stories that we've got are because something's happened to someone, or they wanted to dig into something and then they've really kind of gone into it and they've spent ages on forums. And you kind of have to have that really, if you're like a very, I'm a nosy person. If you're a nosy person, you're willing to spend, like, I'll spend ages just on forums, or like 10 pages back on Google News, or like I'll see like a tiny little nib in a newspaper and I'll start digging really deep into that. And you can spend hours and you can get nowhere. So I always say just kind of keep satisfying that curious side, and then also look into what you can offer, particularly for young journalists, because as I say, now our readership is 20 to 35. And we're the biggest, like, obviously young women's brand that also includes, we really want to speak to our LGBTQ+ audience. It's thinking about what issues that you can bring the editor who might not know. So, like, there's different, are there parties going on that people might not be aware of that hasn't hit the news? It's not just about finding your stories from the news itself. It's about thinking, actually, me and my friends are the news. What does this say, and what can I bring an editorial team? So that, and then also being able to condense a story into something that manages to convey it, that's also shareable, because obviously, like, TikTok and Instagram are big news providers now. For me, being able to provide nuance and balance in journalism is so important. So being able to, if you can provide that kind of nuance, fact-checking, strong journalistic skill, but you can do it in a kind of bite-sized platform, that's such a skill that, like, a lot of newsrooms don't have. So it's kind of thinking about what you can bring rather than looking at, I used to spend so much time just looking at people and being like, why am I not them? Why can I not write like that? But one, everything's gone through so many editing processes, so there's no point comparing your writing to something that's in a newspaper now, because it'll have gone through multiple things. But also two, you don't need to be like someone else. You just have to be you and your interests, and particularly in the Cosmo newsroom, everyone's got their own interests, and I love that. Like, they've all got their own specialities. Like, Jenny's really in, like, she really knows so much about what's going on with cyber abuse at the moment, and she'll always be on the next story. Or, like, there's always just people have got their interests and hone in on that and stay curious.
I think as well, like, I mean, I'm not a journalist, but that's kind of how I navigate my career, like with my publicist. Mm-hmm. I'll have a random idea because there's something I've seen and I'll send it to her and I'll be like, what can we do with this? And if it doesn't stick, it doesn't stick.
Yeah.
But then I'll just be like, well, okay, we'll move on to the next thing. Because if I sit and ponder about that, then I'll miss the next thing that comes
exactly,
through.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, I think if I was like back at school and I had somebody to talk to about something like that, my career could have ended that way anyway.
So, yeah.
Rather than, I mean, I would have been better than sitting in Westminster because I saw the news is anyway, but it would have been a lot more glamorous to be on the glossy side as opposed to like the non-glamorous side. But I know you talk about how you mainly focus on women's issues when it comes mm-hmm. to writing. I did stalk you on LinkedIn. I do that to a lot of people.
I've not
and they're
updated
always like,
my
oh.
LinkedIn in ages. She was.
I mean, I wouldn't be able to tell you any different, so it's okay. But I did see that you like a part of the launch of the Cosmopolitan and is it Men's Health?
Men's Health, yeah.
The sex education?
Yeah, we did a sex education program, which was a couple of years ago. Now it's actually pre-COVID. Okay. Essentially, obviously, we know that there's big, big problems with sex education at the moment, which is not teachers' fault at all. They're really, really time pressed. So we wanted to create materials that were accessible, that spoke directly and spoke about the issues that weren't necessarily or being covered in schools, like consent, like to do with spotting signs of abuse. And ultimately, as with all of these conversations that we have to do with feminism and women's issues, it can't be a conversation that you have alone. You have to bring young men and young boys in, and Men's Health are a brilliant brand who are kind of the only brand that are talking directly and do a lot to do with men's mental health. So we partnered with them. So
what was the, like, I actually don't know what the readership of Men's Health is like. So I don't know what kind of age demographic they tend to pick up.
So, I mean, I probably couldn't comment on that because I don't work directly yeah. with them, but they have done a lot to do with, they've gone into schools speaking to young boys on their mental health. They had like a cute, like an amazing special a couple of years ago, which is directly speaking about mental health and the impact and what young boys are facing. So they were, yeah, the natural brand for us to partner with.
So I was going
to
say, like, obviously now, I mean, it's obviously post-COVID times now, and we're seeing a lot of that stuff kind of appearing online. So I was going to ask if the program was like still running and,
yeah, you know. I mean, it's because it's these booklets. So we gave them out, and I can't remember how many schools I probably should have looked up, but they're still being taught in the schools. And it's always something that we'd be interested to bring back and do more of. It's just, we would need, because you need the cost for the booklet. So
I was always wondering, like, did ever people question why you were doing it? Because if you're a female writer for Cosmo, were they always like, was there ever a question mark as to why you were doing it?
I mean, because we worked with the Men's Health brands, we worked so closely with all of them. So they were kind of working on the content for the boys. We were working on the content for the girls, and we worked together to create this amazing booklet. So,
I mean, what would be kind of like your next goal as a writer? Like, what would be your next thing that you could, if you could do anything?
Oh gosh, I should have thought of something.
I probably should have warned you that would have been a question, to be honest.
I don't know. I guess it's just keeping on. I mean, personally, like, I'm writing my second book. I also write fiction and I also write poetry, and I've got a newsletter to do with grief. So I like telling those kind of personal stories. So yeah, I think it's just kind of carry on spotlighting. I want to keep doing more first persons, more interviewing people who have been at the heart of different stories and have got a different perspective on and voice on the stories that are out there.
I actually found your first book, and it was when I saw it about how old school dating minus dating apps, and I was like, yeah. Does anyone even remember when that was a thing? Because I definitely don't.
No, yeah.
Like, but I think that was one of the books I was like, I need to read that. So it's now on my reading list. But what kind of, I actually wanted to ask you, like, what kind of inspired you to want to write your fiction book in the first place?
So basically, so it's called The Matchmaker, and it's about a matchmaker who kind of sells her services based on her perfect marriage, but she's kind of hiding this secret to do with it. And it's because I interview a lot of experts in my life, in my journalistic life. So, and I've always wondered, sex experts, you can't be amazing at sex all the time. Like, matchmakers, do you have like amazing, or like, or do you know when you watch like Married at First Sight and they're all sitting offering advice and it's like, you must sometimes be a bit of a dick in an argument. Come on. So like,
yeah.
I wanted to kind of have that story and base it on an expert who was kind of not as smart or clued up in her love life as she was selling her services on. But then my main thing was there's a big undercurrent to do with grief in the book. And then also I really, really wanted to do a kind of rom-com book that didn't center, I mean, it looks like it's centering romance as the kind of main thing, but actually centers female friendships and short-lived romance and how we've all got this idea about what the one should look like and what romance should look like when actually we're surrounded by romance. Some of my best friends are some of the most romantic relationships that I've got in my life. And that was something that I just really wanted to do. I wanted to kind of trick people into reading this book that looked like a kind of fluffy romance book, but had like a lot more depth to it.
Yeah, I was reading people's reviews and stuff, and I was like, because romance novels aren't really my thing. I love reading stuff that's like really nitty and gritty. Yeah. And when I saw the reviews and stuff, I was like, yeah, actually, this would be something I'd want to read.
A little bit.
Yeah. I mean, anything to get away from like swiping.
Yeah, it's meant to be quite, people say that it kind of, they get lost in it, which.
Yeah, I mean, so is your second book going to be on a similar theme, or is it going to be completely
different? So it's going to be, it's about grandmother and granddaughter relationship. And it's loosely based on my own relationship I have with my grandma. And it's kind of thinking about the generational divides and the things that our grandparents had to deal with that we perhaps in our modern society completely cannot understand. So she basically finds out that her grandma was having a secret love affair through the Scrabble, and they were sending each other messages through the Scrabble board. So it's got that kind of romance to it, but then the kind of heart is looking into the generational divide and grandma-granddaughter relationships. I was so close to my grandma, I don't think they're spoken about enough.
Yeah, I think actually it would probably be, like they always talk about how there's loneliness and like the divide between young and old people, but yeah, it's never really spoken about.
We just have so much to learn from older people, and I think it's very easy to kind of think like, oh, they're so backwards, or they don't see the world in the same way we do, but they had so much to contend with, and I find that so interesting.
I think arguably not that we see things backwards, but we have a very like need for instant gratification that they don't
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So like I always took that away from my grandparents and my ability to make random food.
Yeah.
There we like go. Jam. That's really good. Which I relearned during lockdown. So that was like, connection to my grandparents.
That is very nice. Yeah.
So obviously you probably won't be talking about jam making in your book, but
I might.
Like, did you ever find as a young woman wanting to be a writer that people were like, you can't really do this, it's not really a career for you?
I got, so actually when I was in journalism school, university, it wasn't journalism school, it sounds so quaint. I had a tutor who kind of, he was like, you're too sensitive for this. You're too emotional to go in to do these hard hitting stories.
All and the words stereotypically associated with women, right?
And I really object to it. Like, I think I was too young to properly think about the time. And I kind of thought, oh, maybe I do need to harden up. Maybe this isn't for me. Maybe I should just do something kind of more softer. But actually now I'm like, those skills are so important. I think empathy is so important in journalism, in your interviewing. I think actually, like I said, reminding yourself why you're doing the story and the real people at the heart of it, and not just... like, particularly at Cosmo, making sure that the people we are interviewing, the stories we're telling, feel happy with those stories and feel comfortable. That means so much to me. And those sensitive qualities, actually, I think have helped me tell the stories and helped people open up in a way that is both important for the world to hear that story, but also important for them in terms of a healing process because they feel comfortable with the journalists. So...
yeah, I think it comes across in pieces when you can tell that the contributor feels comfortable. Mm-hmm. And like as a journalist or like as a reader, you don't really gain anything from like upsetting someone or crossing someone else's boundaries. Like if they've told you something. And
yeah,
then they're like,
it's just not, I would hate it. I had one mistake very early on in my career where the girl that I interviewed wasn't happy with it. And I wrote about it quite recently because it was about 12 years ago and it still plays on my mind. That mistake, and it was basically just me running with a story that she told me because my editor asked me to run with it and not considering her feelings in of that. And it's been one of my biggest regrets and I've never wanted to do it again. I think it's so important to remember, I've said it about a million times, this is a real person rather than a statistic.
There's always so many negative connotations when you talk about journalists, like There was when I was younger, it's like, oh, always be careful of, or when I worked in civil service, always be careful of journalists, because if you tell them one thing, they'll literally just print it straight away. Yeah. So like to actually hear from a journalist who has empathy and doesn't just want to just take any story they physically can.
Yeah, and I mean, I think a lot of the people that I work with are very, very similar mindset. But yeah, we do have a bad reputation. Or I'll be at dinner party and someone will be like, oh, you're not going to write about me, are you? And I'm like, you're not interesting enough.
I've definitely asked people that question.
You're interesting. Honestly, I'll be with someone that's talking, they're telling me the most boring story. And they're like, oh, actually, better stop. And I'm like, yeah, stop, because it's boring. Not because
I have to stop myself telling you stuff, because it will be interesting and it will get like printed. So I don't want that. But no, I'm definitely guilty of saying that sentence. I'm really sorry.
No, don't worry.
What would, like, I always kind of end my episodes on a similar question. So I always want to know, what would you say to people that doubted, well, especially to your university professor that doubted your ability to be a successful journalist based on the fact that you're a woman?
Mm-hmm. What would I say? I guess I would say, I think that one of the things that upsets me most in so many conversations to do with, like, you know, like, remove qualifiers from email, stop saying please and thank you, you're making yourself be so feminine. It's like, let's start championing feminine traits. Let's start championing those skills in the workplace more, because they're so valuable. Let's stop trying to make women act more like men. Let's start making it the other way around, or bringing those, that kind of empathy in, because those skills that you're often taught are soft or silly or naive can often be the kind of strongest things that you can bring into it.
I think especially if you're in a people role,
yeah,
and you have to manage people. I've always, like, teams that have been managed by women, I always feel like I feel more comfortable in.
So, yeah.
Because there is some element of empathy.
Mm-hmm.
So I would agree with that sentiment, though I am one of those really harsh email people.
So are you?
I'm half and half.
I'm very like, oh, would you mind? I need to pull back a little bit, but.
I think in person I'm like that, but then across in emails, no, I'm very like.
Straight up.
Blunt. It's because I'm usually doing something else at the same time. But no, honestly, I loved hearing about all of your stuff, and like, I find your career so aspirational. Aww. And I know that there's so many people out there that were like, will have asked me questions about journalism and be so interested to hear your stories. And I'm actually going to go and find certain articles now, because I didn't know that you had a transparent. So I'd actually be really interested to read that.
Well, yeah, I love all the work. I admire all the work you're doing too. So hopefully we can work together on a story in the future too.
I love having guests, like, they fill my ego massively. Thank you so much.
Thank you.